Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone, to The Revelation of Jesus with Rick Sterling.
What are you going to do? The Lord above gave you a life to serve Him and the knowledge of what's right and wrong to do. In your sinful, selfish ways, you have forgotten Him. On the judgment day, what are you going to do? What are you going to do, a sinner, when God calls your name on that phone?
Want to welcome you to our show today. And we are happy that you have been here with us all along. We hope that you'll join us today as we go through and have our study. Today is August 12, 2017. My name is Dennis Neufeld, and this indeed is the revelation of Jesus.
On the judgment day, what are you going to do?
A sinner, when God calls your name on that final judgment day, when you face your God, can you stand alone?
Oh, sinner, what are you going to do? The time has come to think of where you're going. The time to change your wicked, sinful way. God is calling now, but He will not call forever. And His mercy ends on the judgment day. What are you going to do?
Do, oh sinner, when God calls your name on that final judgment day. When you face your God, can you stand alone?
Oh sinner, what are you going to do?
Oh sinner,
what are you going to do?
We are here in our studio getting ready for our program. I want to call your attention to our chat room. Our chat room is up in case you have any questions or comments that you'd like to make. You can make them there and I'll pass them along. I've also posted links to our official website at spiritoftruthministry.net and our spiritoftruthministry.net/SSM original website. You can go there for a lot of historical data and a lot of writing by the rest of us. SpiritOfTruthMinistry.net, the primary website, has our book, The Spirit of the Church by Rick Sterling and me, Dennis Neufeld, and lots and lots of writing by Rick. And we hope that you will go there and use that as a resource. Let's prepare and we will get started with our program. Thank you, Father, for taking care of us today in spirit and in truth, for granting us peace, for helping us to enjoy our time together through your Spirit, the Spirit of Truth. Father, do not let us succumb to the evil ministry of Satan and his demons by accepting confusion, by being contentious. I pray, Father, that today we will be in your spirit as we look at the words of Jesus Christ, as we look at the words of God the Father in the Old Testament. Thank you for those words, and thank you for coming again soon so that we can go to our home in heaven. And I pray this in the name of Jesus. Amen. Good morning, Larry. Good morning, Rick. Good morning.
Good morning.
Looks like we have Dr. Don and Mike is on the phone. So good morning, everyone. We are glad that you are here.
I hope you all had an opportunity to listen to the study yesterday. If you haven't, strongly encourage you to listen to it, download it, put it on your device, share it with your family, your friends, your neighbors. I guarantee you, they will have never heard anything even approaching what was presented yesterday.
I will second that. It was an eye opener,
and it explains a lot. And again, the heart of the discussion study was two verses in Genesis. And the subject of the presentation is what is the meaning of redemption and the payment that was made and who received the payment. And yesterday I explained when the debt was incurred. The man and the woman in the garden were seduced by the serpent, who was not a snake, but was one of the gods of this world, small g, the devil, Satan, Lucifer, the evil one, goes by many names, all of them very descriptive of his characteristics. I pointed out that the man and the woman recognized him as one of the gods of the world. That it would make a good argument in their mind that this God would know how to become a God like himself. And told that all they needed to do was to eat from that tree which Elohim had expressly forbidden them from doing. And that Elohim was misleading them when they said they would be put to death on the day if they ever did eat the fruit from the tree. The man and the woman knew exactly what would happen to them if they ate from that tree. They knew exactly that God had forbidden them from eating that tree, from that tree. The woman even said God forbade them from even touching that tree. And if they ever did, he would put them to death.
Kind of reminds me a little bit about the poison apple. You're not supposed to touch it. You're not supposed to look at it. You're not supposed to, certainly not supposed to eat it. And just in our pre-show prep, you were talking about why it was that she felt like was capable of doing that and not being killed. So would you explain that one?
Did the man and the woman know they were mortal? And that may come as a surprise to many people who have not followed along with us for a while. The new people would say, well, they were created mortal. Were they?
That's an assumption. If they were immortal, then why did God have a tree that would, if they ate from it regularly, give them immortality?
Do you think that Elohim told Lucifer that if he ever disobeyed them, they would put him to death on the day that of his disobedience?
There's no record of that ever having taken place.
Is Lucifer an eternal being?
Absolutely.
Yes. Every spiritual being is eternal. They do not decay. They do not waste away. They do not age. as we understand aging. So how then is it that Elohim could tell the man and woman that if they were to ever eat from the tree in the garden on the day of their disobedience, they would be put to death? And many people say, well, they didn't even know what death was. They were immortal. Then it would be ridiculous for God to put a tree in a garden called the tree of life so that the man and the woman could eat from that tree and live forever. Because that is exactly what it says in Genesis. Now that the man and the woman have become like one of us, it says that right in there. The man and the woman have become like one of us, knowing good and evil, and all now they need to do is to eat the fruit of the tree of life, and they will live forever. And what was the decision of Elohim?
To remove them from the garden.
Remove them from the garden. Man and the woman were mortal when they were created. So their state of being mortal was not the penalty for eating from the tree. They never received the penalty from eating from the tree. Therefore, they incurred a debt which they did not pay. For if it was the death of a mortal, if it was becoming mortal, then when they died, they paid the debt, and the debt would not be left unpaid and would not have to be paid by another. Once the debt is paid, the debt is paid. But the debt needed to be paid.
By the way, that verse that you quoted, behold, the man has become like one of us, that is found in Genesis 3:22.
I don't know why God, in effect, let life go on without trying to establish his kingdom throughout the antediluvian world. There were those who honored him, although they seemed to be very few, very, very few in number. The line from Seth down to the 10th generation from the man and the woman in the garden, and his name was Noah. And you know the account of Noah. For in his lifetime, God sent a deluge, and the water covered the face of the earth completely, and every living thing that could not survive in water was put to death unless they were on the ark. During the lifetime of Noah, I believe it was about 60 years before he died, Elohim came to earth and spoke to a man who lived in Ur. His name is Abram. And you know the story of Abram. God made a promise to Abram. The promise was that he would make a great nation, a great kingdom of his offspring, and that God was going to lead him to a land where he would sojourn, he would travel. It would not be his land, but he would live in it. But God promised that 430 years later, his offspring would be given that land and they would have it as their own.
This story begins in Genesis 12.
Why was God doing this? Mention. Elohim had, for all intents and purposes, lost authority over this world. It had been taken by the spiritual beings who had come here to be the teachers of mankind and to watch over them.
Got a question for you. In the garden, when Adam and Eve disobeyed, what was it that they gave away to Satan? Because the garden is separated from the world, but yet it's in the world. What does the garden represent?
The garden represents God's kingdom on earth. Just as God planted a garden in the east in Eden, he set that land area apart from the rest of the world to put his created being, his man, in, where he could live apart from the world until he would be able to accomplish the plan of restoring the whole world to God, which the evil one knew full well that is what God's plan was. He knew what God's plan was. He knew what God needed to do to accomplish it, and he knew how to keep God, how to prevent God from accomplishing his plan of restoration. You make the people believe a lie. You tell them that God does not punish. God does not judge. And of course, who wants to be judged? Who wants to be punished? God does not expect you to be righteous. God does not expect you to obey his law because he knows you can't. Your flesh and blood and flesh is evil. The flesh was created evil. It is the flesh that makes man do the things that man does that are against God's will. But that is not what God says. But of course, the evil one presents himself as God. He can lie. He can change his appearance. He can be an angel of light. He can be a demon of darkness. He can be a loving, caring Savior. And he can be an evil, sadistic destroyer. He can be whatever he wants to be in the sight of man. He's told believers that they are saved by grace. They are not saved by keeping the law. They are not saved by obedience. Why is it necessary for mankind to be saved then? Well, saved From what? Certain destruction? But what is that destruction? You know, I've talked to pastors who absolutely deny the fact that there's going to be any kind of judgment and destruction and horrific events, and such has never been since there was a nation until that time and never will be again. They tell me that all that language is all symbolic and it has absolutely no foot in fact. It is all just a big metaphor describing the battle of good and evil. There's no day of accountability coming. There's no time where you will have to stand before the righteous judge and give an account for every decision that you've made, for every practice that you've participated in, for every single lie that you have held to be true and practiced. Don't worry. Be happy. God loves you. And he wants nothing except to save you.
I find it interesting. First of all, in Genesis 15, God says to Abraham that his descendants will be in captivity 400 years. I find it interesting that in Genesis 17, God uses in reference to what Abram needs to do in order to qualify as the progenitor of the kingdom of heaven. It says here in Genesis 17:1, "Now when Abraham was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, 'I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be,'" "Don't worry about it, I'll give grace." No, the word there is blameless. So when Abram accepted this covenant, did this, what would you call it, regenerate the kingdom of heaven at that time, or was that for later?
The promise of a kingdom would be later.
But
I mean, the promise of the kingdom came, the kingdom
would come later.
Would come later.
But this is the promise of the kingdom that Adam and Eve gave away in the garden. And see, this is the connection. This is what I really find fascinating. You asked earlier, why did God do all of this with Abraham and Abraham's descendants? He did it because he has to have a functioning kingdom of righteousness on the earth in order to bring the earth back to him.
And what makes the kingdom righteous?
Walking before him and being blameless.
No, what makes the kingdom righteous?
The words.
The people. The people.
Right.
In the kingdom are righteous in fact. If they
right.
are not righteous in fact, they are no better than the people around the kingdom.
And they become righteous by abiding in the words of God.
They
living
become
them.
Righteous by learning about God and coming
right.
to know God. Time that the children of Israel spent in the land of Egypt. They had their fathers had gone there. Well, the 12 patriarchs and their father, Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel. They had gone to the land of Egypt because of a great famine. It was a worldwide famine. And the only food that could be had was in the land of Egypt. And it's interesting how that came to be, because you know the story of Joseph. Joseph was a son of Jacob, Israel. And he was Jacob's favorite. He showed him great favor for some reason, and this made his brothers jealous. And, you know, Joseph had a dream. Sun, the moon, and the stars all bowed down to him. And his brothers' sheaves of wheat bowed down to his sheaf of wheat. Interesting, isn't it? He relayed the dream because it had such meaning, and his brothers ridiculed him and hated him. And you know the story. He went to take his brothers some food and provisions. They were off quite a distance away from home. And his brothers decided to get rid of him once and for all. They threw him into a pit, took his coat of many colors, drenched it in goat blood so they could deceive their father into believing they had found him mauled and dead.
You know that they were lucky there was no such thing as DNA testing back then.
They were going to kill him and be rid of him. But you see, God had a plan for Joseph. And God worked through the oldest brother, Reuben, who didn't want to kill him, but he didn't want his brothers to think that he was trying to prevent it. He wanted his brothers to make the decision not to kill him because they could benefit better from selling him into slavery and then kill him. And then he'd go away and they'd never see him again.
Oh, the lesser of two evils. Oh, gosh.
So Joseph went to Egypt. Joseph was purchased by the captain of the guard of Pharaoh. He was a servant in the house of the captain. And, of course, the wife of the captain of the guard, Potiphar, tried to get Joseph in bed with her, and he would not do it.
And, by the way, just as a side, it is said by several sources, that historical sources, that Potiphar was a eunuch, which is why his wife was not happy.
Well,
so
whether
that's the case or not.
Joseph was...
Remember, you heard it here first.
Joseph was falsely accused, thrown into prison, and forgotten about again. There were two fellow prisoners who had dreams. Somehow or another, they felt these dreams had some meaning that they needed to know, and so they were relaying this and wanting to know what the meaning of the dream was, and Joseph told them. They would both be freed and get their jobs. Well, one would get his job back, and one would be put to death. And that's exactly what happened. And all Joseph asked was that they tell Pharaoh that he's in prison and, you know, that he's been falsely accused and da-da-da. But what about Joseph?
You mean they didn't read him his Miranda rights?
You see, there was a purpose for Joseph. Everything that happened to him was for a reason. And it was all leading up to a certain time. Because the way he got out of prison was that Pharaoh had a dream. And oh, the cupbearer, he remembered there was a man in prison that told him what his dream was, and that's exactly what happened. So, of course, Pharaoh brought Joseph out of prison. Joseph told him what his dream was all about. Joseph was made vice Pharaoh. He was in charge of the land of Egypt. And, of course, he put together a plan so that Egypt and the rest of the world would survive the 7 years of famine. And I understand that if you go to Egypt today, you can see the grain silos. They're underground. They're dug down into the ground. They're not up above ground. With some grain still in the bottom. It's a masterful work, these silos. How one feeds into another, feeds into a main silo. There's little cubicles where people could make their exchanges.
And I read on one of the historical sites that they actually planted some of that grain, and it sprouted, it grew, and it is essentially what we would call red winter wheat, which is extremely hardy and it is not susceptible to pests.
It's resilient. And there is some, I don't know if you want speculation, you can call it speculation, or there's a thought that they've actually discovered the name that Joseph had while in Egypt when he was Pharaoh. You know what his name, what that name is? I am Hotep, or Imhotep.
Huh.
And Pharaoh,
huh, that is interesting.
Who was Pharaoh at that time, was Dozier. So look it up. Might be interesting study for you. Anyway, the time came when the Pharaoh and his court did not remember Joseph. And as the Hebrews multiplied exponentially, they were afraid that they might supplant the Egyptians, and so they made the Hebrews slaves.
And we talked about that a little bit yesterday. The verse is Exodus 1:8. Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph.
And he said to these subjects, these people, the sons of Israel, have become too numerous and strong. They are a threat to us. We must be prudent and take steps against their increasing any further. Or if war should break out, they might add to the number of our enemies. They might take arms against us and to escape out of this country. Accordingly, they put slave drivers over the Israelites to wear them down under heavy loads. In this way, they built the store cities of Pithom and Ramses for Pharaoh. Now, Ramses, I want to say something about this, that the name of that city at that time was not Ramses. As scribes would copy the law, the names of areas, countries, cities would change. The name of the city at the time this happened was Tanis. And the reason that I know that it was not Ramses is because Ramses was not even, had not even been born yet, either Ramses the first or Ramses the second. In fact, the note here in my Bible says, the residence of Ramses II in the Delta, either Tanis or Kuntir. Tanis, the city where Joseph lived. It was the seat of Pharaoh's throne in Lower Egypt. Lower Egypt was near the Nile Delta.
And
Upper Egypt was where Luxor and
Memphis. Were also known as the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom.
So when Tanis' name was changed to Ramses, when Ramses II, I believe it was, changed the name, and the scribes were copying the law, they put in Ramses instead of Tanis because the name of that place was, at that time, now when they were writing it, was Ramses. They would do the same thing today. If a street name changes, they put in the new name. They don't keep the old name because no one would know how to find that street using the old name. They would have to know what the new name was. So it's the same thing here. And the reason that I say this is that when the Exodus occurred, it was not during the reign of Ramses II. Was actually during the reign of Moses. Moses. Anyway, you know the story of Moses. You know that he killed an Egyptian who was beating a Hebrew, and he fled to Midian. He married one of the seven daughters of the priests of Midian. Then Moses, this is Exodus chapter 3. Moses was looking after the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, priest of Midian. He led his flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There, the angel of Yahweh appeared to him in the shape of a flame of fire coming from the middle of a bush. Moses looked. There was the bush blazing, but it was not being burnt up. I must go and look at this strange sight, Moses said, and see why the bush is burnt. Yahweh saw him go forward to look, and Elohim called to him from the middle of the bush. Moses, Moses, he said. Here I am, he answered. Come no nearer, he said. Take off your shoes, for the place on which you stand is holy ground. I am the God of your father, he said, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses covered his face, afraid to look at Elohim. Did Moses know God who spoke to him from the bush?
Certainly not.
No,
he did not.
Did he know about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? He may have known of them, but he didn't really know about them. In fact, the gods that he would have been educated for were the gods of Egypt. And now here is a god in the flame of fire telling him he is the god of his forefathers. Elohim goes on to say that I have seen the miserable state of my people in Egypt. These are his people of the promise. They are not his people yet. Understand that. He in here states that he made a promise to Abraham, reaffirmed it to Isaac and Jacob. He made a promise that of their offspring, he would make a great kingdom. So they were his people because he had made a promise, but they were not his people yet. So just understand the difference between they were his because he had promised to make them his, but they were not his to rule and control.
At this point, they belonged to Pharaoh.
To deliver them out of the hands of the Egyptians and bring them up out of that land to a land rich and broad, a land where milk and honey flow, the home of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. And now the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me, and I have witnessed the way in which the Egyptians oppress them. So come, I send you to Pharaoh to bring the sons of Israel, my people, out of Egypt. Moses said to Elohim, who am I to go to Pharaoh and bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? I shall be with you, was the answer. And this is the sign by which you shall know that it is I who have sent you. After you have led the people out of Egypt, you are to offer worship to God on this mountain. There's a key word there that I read, and I hope you caught it. It's in verse 8, and it is the word deliver. I mean to deliver them out of the hands of the Egyptians. Then Moses said to Elohim, I am to go then to the sons of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. But if they ask me, what is his name? Okay. What is Moses? Now, first of all, I know what Dennis is thinking. Moses is trying to get God to reveal his name. Here's the thing. Moses doesn't know the name of this God. In fact, he doesn't even know this God. He knows probably about this God. Now, I was taught when I was just little kid, and I told you my dad was a pastor, my mom's a teacher, and in Sabbath school class, I was told that, Pharaoh was killing all the male children. Of Hebrews, all the males were being killed, and that Moses' mother, Jochebed, did not want Moses to be put to death, so she hid him in the bulrushes in a little place in the Nile, and the Pharaoh's daughter came down and found him, and Miriam, his sister, said to Pharaoh's daughter, I have a wet nurse that will take the child and nurse him, bring him up. And Pharaoh's daughter said, yes, and then when he comes of age, you can bring him into the court of Pharaoh. And that God did that so that Moses' mother would instruct him in the knowledge of the God of Israel, so that he would know the God of Israel. She didn't know the God of Israel. She may have known of him, but she did not know him, them. And Moses did not know Elohim. He knew the gods of Egypt. Those are the gods he had been instructed about in the court of Pharaoh, in the schools of the Pharaohs. So Moses said to God, I am to go then to the sons of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. But if they ask me, what is his name? What am I to tell them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. This, he added, what you must say to the sons of Israel. I am has sent me to you. And God said to Moses, you are to say to the sons of Israel, Yahweh, the Elohim of your fathers, the Elohim of Abraham, of Isaac, and Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name for all time. By this name I shall be invoked for all generations to come. I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. Dennis, would you look up in Matthew where Jesus says that? Now turn to Exodus. Exodus chapter 11. Then Yahweh said to Moses, one disaster more I shall bring on Pharaoh and on Egypt. Just one. Yes, Jim.
John 14:6. Jesus said to him, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. No one comes to the Father but through me.
Where he said, before Abraham was born, I am. And I think that's in Matthew. After this, he will let you go from here. Indeed, he will drive you out. Instruct the people that every man is to ask his neighbor, every woman hers, for silver ornaments and gold. And Yahweh gave the people prestige in the eyes of the Egyptians, while Moses himself was a man of great importance in the land of Egypt and of high prestige with Pharaoh's courtiers and with the people. Okay, Dennis?
John 8:58, Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born, I am.
And what did they do?
Wanted to stone him.
What it says, and they picked up stones to stone him, but he hid himself. So, in fact, who is the Son of God saying he is?
The same person who talked to Abraham.
The name of Israel's God.
Correct.
That's why they picked up stones to stone him, because they saw him as a blasphemer. He was there. So all those Jehovah's Witnesses who say that Jesus was just a man who was not a God and who did not exist prior to his birth from Mary need to explain why Jesus would use the name and not be a blasphemer. Moses said, this is Yahweh's message, towards midnight I shall pass through Egypt. All the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die. There's that same word, the same one that was used in the garden in Eden. That night you will die. Not of old age, not of natural causes. They would be put to death by the destroying angel, probably the angel of the Lord. From the firstborn of Pharaoh, heir to his throne, to the firstborn of the maidservant at the mill, and all the firstborn of the cattle, and throughout the land of Egypt, there shall be such a wailing as never was heard before, nor will be again. But against the sons of Israel, against man or beast, never a dog shall bark, so that you may know that Yahweh discriminates between Egypt and Israel. Then all these courtiers of yours will come down to me and bow low before me and say, go away, you and all the people who follow you. After this I shall go. And hot with anger, Yahweh said to Moses, Pharaoh will not listen to you, so that my wonders may be multiplied in the land of Egypt. All these wonders Moses and Aaron worked in the presence of Pharaoh. But Yahweh made Pharaoh's heart stubborn, and he did not let the sons of Israel leave his country. Now, because we're short on time, I am going to just describe what is going on here, and I encourage you to read it for yourself. God instituted the Passover, and I want to say something about the feasts. There were three great feasts, and there were minor ones, but the three great feasts, the religious feasts or festivals sometimes called, had specific meaning. What happened was is that the feasts themselves became the requirement. What God wanted is that Israel would learn through participation in the feast, so that they would understand that sacrifices and the offerings and all of that that they were making was not the means to the end.
Well, was not the end. It was the means to the end.
Well, but he wanted them to learn how the process of sanctification and salvation worked.
Yes.
By active participation in a process which mirrored the process that, in fact, took place, they would learn about it. The Passover lamb. The blood of the Passover lamb that was applied, the doorpost and the lintel of each house of the Israelites, that was only a sign. It was a sign that that house had been purchased by the blood of the Passover lamb. Everyone in there had been redeemed from the land of Egypt and from Pharaoh. They had belonged to Egypt and the Pharaoh. Through the blood of the Passover lamb, they had been redeemed, bought back by God. When he lost to the gods of Egypt, who were the same gods, the serpent that was in the garden, seducing the couple in the garden. He was God of Egypt, Ra. Or whatever you wanted to call him. He was the god of Egypt, the main god.
And as we learned last week and yesterday, the purchase price is paid to someone.
Right.
In this case, the purchase price was paid to
the serpent.
The same being that the purchase price of the cross was paid to. And you see, the lesson is, this is the Passover is looking forward to that event.
Now, the Son of God, we know, was the Passover lamb. In fact, here in Egypt, they had Passover lambs, but they pointed toward a purchase price and blood that would be made. All those living in the land of Egypt, on that night, all firstborn were put to death that did not have the purchase price on the door. Because all firstborn belonged to God. the man that God formed, Adam. He was the firstborn earth son of God, earth man son of God, firstborn. Cain was a firstborn. God did not put him to death because of his grievous sin. Firstborn, first fruits belong to God, always. So God had a right to put them to death because they belonged to him. God had a right to spare them because he had purchased them from the evil one. When the Son of God put to death by his Father, because it was the Father who would put the man and the woman to death for disobeying and eating from that tree, they didn't. And that death was unpaid. He put his Son to death. And there was an event pointing forward to this when God commanded Abraham to take his only son, Isaac, his firstborn from Sarah, take him to a spot that he would direct him to and sacrifice him there. And you know the story. He took him there and he was ready to slit his throat, and the angel of the Lord prevented him. And there was a ram. The ram was then slain in his place. All of this has meaning for us to learn from. So just as God showed how his people would be purchased by the blood of the Passover lamb, his kingdom at the end of time will have been redeemed by the blood of the Passover lamb. God took Israel out into the wilderness to teach them about himself. He gave them the law. He told Moses what to write down so that the people would know. They would learn what God needed them to know. They would come to know the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, because God would give them that information. This is the same information we have now. The same information. God has preserved it. God has promised us that he will preserve it so that we can read it and we can understand it and we can learn it, just as the Israelites could have done, but they didn't. For this is how we learn about righteousness. We must be sanctified by the truth. We must keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of the Son of God.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you for that great study. Thank you all for being here today. I encourage you to go to our Blog Talk Radio website this afternoon, and you can download this and many other programs as your heart desires. We encourage you to join us next Friday at 10 a.m. for another edition of the Bible on Trial, and a week from today for another edition of the Revelation of Jesus. On behalf of Spirit of Truth Ministry, this is Dennis Neufeld saying so long for now. We'll see you next week.